KBOO Portland.
Oh, I wish there's a mole in the ground. Oh, I wish there's a mole in the ground. If there's a mole in the ground, then I'd root the mountains down. Oh, I wish there's a mole in the ground. Oh, I wish there's Giannata's sunglasses. Oh, I wish there's Giannata's sunglasses. If I's not his sunglasses, then I'd show you messages hiding before your very eyes.
Good morning, and welcome to the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Portland. I'm your host today, Fran Michelle. Our engineer is Patsy Kulberg. Our theme song was performed by Joe Clement. The Old Mole takes its name from Karl Marx's term for the revolutionary forces that subvert the terrain of capital and capitalism. On today's show, we'll be considering some of the ways that Oregonians have been pushing back against capital power through the tools of the bourgeois state. The most recent session of the Oregon legislature addressed unpredictable scheduling and the cost of public transit fares, among other issues. We'll start today's show with a conversation between Bill Resnick and economist Mary King, co-author of the report on the impact on Oregonians of the rise of irregular scheduling. That's a problem that the legislature has sought to address in its session with SB 828, which requires large employers in specified industries to provide new employees with estimated work schedules and to provide current employees with 7 days' notice of work schedules. That can still leave difficulties in planning, but it's better than no notice. Then we'll end today's show with Desiree Heligers talking with Maria Hernandez Segoviano of Opal Environmental Justice about recent successes and future work on public transportation, including the recently passed bill that provides for state investments in mass transit and including the move to low-income fare equity on TriMet. In between, we'll have an interlude on the subversions of art, with bookmole Larry Bolden reviewing the fantasy novel for grown-ups, The Snow Child, by Iowan Ivey, and with Joe and Raisa telling us about that rad woman, polystyrene. As always, you'll be able to find the podcast of the show and its segments in a day or two on our website at kboo.fm. We also invite you to like the Old Mole Variety Hour on Facebook and to follow us at Old Mole on Twitter. If you're interested in getting involved with The Mole, or if you have suggestions, comments, or questions, you can reach us via our KBOO webpage or at oldmolevarietyhour, all one word, at gmail.com. We turn now to Bill Resnick and Mary King talking about work scheduling.
Mary King, welcome to KBOO.
Thanks a lot, Bill. I'm glad to be here.
Mary King was for many years the chair of Portland State University's economics department. She served and still serves on the Portland Jobs with Justice Workers' Rights Board. She's written a great deal, recently retired from teaching, but not from working with progressive organizations and doing progressive research. I read her most recent work, The Impact on Oregonians of the Rise of Irregular Scheduling. Reading the report and looking at the numbers, as well as the testimony and lives of irregular workers, regular people doing irregular work, I began thinking this irregular scheduling and work is virtual slavery. Being always on call, paid maybe a subsistence wage, rarely a full day's work, some weeks very little, and subject to firing at any time for any reason at all, or no reason. Mary King, tell us about irregular work in Oregon around the country and how it impacts the workers and their families.
I'd be glad to, Bill. Thanks a lot. Let me just mention that, yes, The recent study that I just worked on was a collaborative effort with Rahi Reddy and Ellen Scott, both at the University of Oregon. And we worked closely with Work and Families Party canvassers who were interviewing people and had the generous support of UFCW to make this thing happen. The issue that we're focused on here is the rise and really rapid expansion of irregular scheduling. Now, irregular scheduling refers to a whole set of practices that's especially happening in retail and hospitality and healthcare, but really a number of industries beyond that as well. And what
fast food, hugely.
Food service. And what it is, it's providing people very short notice of their work schedules, sometimes less than 24 hours, making frequent changes in the work schedules, scheduling people for really variable hours from week to week. One week you might have 8, another 30, implementing really different start times. So you might start at 4 in the afternoon or 4 in the morning on different days. You might close late and open early. You might be sent home early without pay. You have to be on call. You may or may not be called into work. You get no pay if you're not called in. Some people arrive at work and are sent home without pay.
That's amazing. You could take a bus for 2 hours in this city if you live in where poor people are being pushed out to, making 3 connections, and arrive at work and they say, oh, sorry, we don't need you today.
That's precisely what's happening.
And they don't even pay for the transportation.
And you have to think about...
It is like criminal.
It's criminal. And it's not just transportation, which is a huge already investment of time, as you say, and money, but it's people's child care. They are having to arrange care for their children on this sort of last-minute basis. They can't have their kids in regular child care, so it's the people that they're getting help from are also on an irregular and last-minute schedule, and it means they lose access to the highest quality child care, which has proven to really make incredible differences in kids' school outcomes and future life prospects. So, there are all these kinds of things. They have to have open availability.
Open availability means you can't take a second job.
You cannot take a second
job.
Because
if you tell them, sorry, I have something to do or something that's important, or I have to go to the doctor, they may say, well, next week you might not get as much time. Or any of the myriad punishments that low-level managers can inflict on people who are not completely subservient.
And that's exactly what Oregon's are reporting. That is exactly it. They are in these jobs then that may take them down to hours of only 8 a week or otherwise be nearly full-time. But if they say, look, I really need to work around my child care schedule, my medical schedule, my child custody schedule, my school schedule, a second job, no, people are being punished. They're getting terrible shifts and few hours or let go altogether. So it's a trap. It really is a trap.
And they can't belong to clubs that meet frequently. You can't be part of a bowling league because you have to stay open at all times.
Exactly. You can't do politics. You can't go to church. You can't make your kids' parent-teacher conferences. You cannot schedule medical care or family vacations. You can't even plan a family barbecue, is what we're being told.
You talked about one woman, one of the interviews of the woman that was published in your study. She was a devoted churchgoer.
Right.
And she said, I'll work any time you want me to, late at night, I'll open, I'll close, I'll do as many hours as you want, but on Sunday mornings I have to go to church.
Right.
And what happened to her?
Yeah, she started to be punished. She had her hours cut, and the manager refused not to schedule her for Sundays. Exactly as you said. She said she would work any regular schedule, Monday through Saturday, any shift. No, if she wouldn't commit to working Sundays, forget it. And he continued to schedule her for Sundays.
Well, think of it from the point of view of the manager, who is not paid very much more than the people and can also be cashiered very rapidly, right? Because there are other people who want these jobs of $2 more per hour than the minimum wage. From their point of view, if you get a lot of people, one says, I can't work this hour, one says, I can't do that hour, it's much more complicated on the computer and all of the rest. And furthermore, they don't like being limited somehow. I mean, these poor people who are in the managerial things, and especially in fast foods, which is really low paid, and where they can hire managers very rapidly from the current staff. You know, somebody will take that
job,
which is, I think, the way they do it mostly.
Well, Bill, you really hit it with talking about the complexity of the computers, because a lot of this has emerged with new scheduling software that people are using. When you read the reviews of it, quite complex, difficult to manage, and turns out they treat labor then as just-in-time inventory, just like you would a soybean. I only want to store a soybean in my shed if I know I'm going to use it in the next hour. So they're treating labor like that, that we'll just pull it in exactly when we want it. But this software is not very good, or it's very challenging to make work well. So that people are being scheduled with this software, but the schedules they're getting are much more variable than consumer demand. I mean, the idea is, well, we only want to schedule people when we know there will be people coming into the store. So if the weather's bad or something goes on, we want to be able to adjust quickly. But they're adjusting far more variably than is true for their business.
Well, that may be, but even if the software was perfect, it would make it even worse, it seems to me, because they could get rid of people even much more easily if they were rational, if they were completely rational.
Well, I have to disagree with you there, partly, because the software is producing worse schedules than necessary, even if you want to meet the flow of demand.
Yeah.
The flow of business is really much more steady than the schedules. I do agree with you on the other point. I mean, in one way, what they're doing, they are shifting the risk of business on to the lowest paid people with the least ability to organize that business. So the risk of business is, it might snow one day and, you know, only half the people are going to make it in. Well, that's a risk you take as a business owner. We talk about the return to capital is for bearing risk, and you have to have responsibility for your management. But your lowest paid employees, many of whom are earning so little that they are definitely supported by EITC, they are far more likely to be on food stamps than the labor force in general, but they are just, if not more likely to have kids at home, are bearing that risk without ability then to change their situation by taking a second job or get further training.
Yeah. This is Bill Resnick for the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm talking to Mary King, Emerita, professor of economics at Portland State, who's still extremely active in progressive organizations and doing research. We're talking about her latest co-authored research, The Impact on Oregonians of the Rise of Irregular Scheduling. It's also the impact across the United States. And we've been talking about the terrible position that these low-paid people who have virtually no power and are being forced to work whatever hours the managers, using computer technology that's not very good, ask them to work. And sometimes come to work and then are sent home to take the two-hour bus ride back without any compensation if the computer made a slight mistake about almost anything. Anyway, Mary, let's talk about it, though, from the point of view of these companies.
Right.
It's not that every company boss is utterly cruel and merciless and just wants to destroy people and destroy their families and make life bad for them. They, of course, have their own therapy bills for their kids and the yacht bill and the people who run the yacht and all the rest of it. I mean, they have a lot of expenses. But even if they were these kinds of, there's always a few of them who are skinflints and who live in a little apartment somewhere and just accumulate vast amounts of money. I mean, there must be one at least like that. In any event, even if they weren't that, have these huge compensation states, they'll be cashiered if they don't make as much money as the next company down, especially in fast food that's really competitive. There's a different form of exploitations, actually. They have to show these huge profits, or they get fired. The CEOs who don't show at least average prices just get axed by Wall Street. Mm-hmm. who basically run these firms, and they only last for about 5 years, so they want to clean up. They have to clean up. This is for them, and to just keep a job. They are forced to use this system, but system capitalism is just more cruel than almost anywhere else on this planet to low-wage workers. because of the high technology and because of the ease of doing these things, and because they basically dominate the state. They dominate government everywhere. Let's talk about the statutory basis. How do they get away with things like this? Of people being called to come to work in a regular work and then being told, go home.
Yeah, let me say two things, Bill. One is you're absolutely right that an unchecked market economy will create that kind of discipline and pressure on the low-level managers, middle managers, even upper managers to make the most money possible, because capitalism is a competitive system. It's not competitive in the way that they teach you in the Econ 1 textbooks, you know, where the firms don't have power. The firms have a lot of power, but they're using that power to compete with each other for access to capital, and they have to show the highest returns possible. So that is absolutely the case. And we see that in not only emerging in these irregular schedules, but the degree to which firms are now shedding regular workers. So even the wealthiest, most prosperous companies, the big ones, the most monopolized, Bank of America, people like that are said to have 20 to 50% of their workforce effectively outsourced, working as contractors, and then those contractors compete like crazy with each other. So that is absolutely right.
And they can be fired. They don't get benefits. These contractors, they're all independent contractors. And they're doing that at also even lower levels, hiring people without any benefits at all. Of course, they get out of benefits in these really low-wage places just by keeping people at under 30 hours a week, and then benefits don't apply,
right.
Whatever. A lot of companies don't even have any benefits at all. And, of course, the universities, for another reason, there's very few people now hired, or a very small percentage of people are hired for a regular 40-hour week with benefits and any sense of security at all.
No, that's absolutely true. And Harvard economists showed that of the job growth in the last 10 years, more than all of it was in this temporary and contingent. But we do need to get to solutions, because the only way. The market is not going to fix this. The companies are not going to fix this. It takes regulation. And you're absolutely right that the companies and the wealthy have far too much power over our governments. But people have figured out strategies. One on the irregular scheduling specifically was passed by San Francisco and implemented in 2014. And they have put standards. You need to give people so many hours. They need to have so much notice of their schedule. They need to be able to have input in their schedule. You need to pay them more if you cut their hours late or ask them late in with little notice to work fewer or more hours. So there are policy practices out there. It's been very successfully working in San Francisco. Seattle has passed something similar, which is now going into effect just in July. And
how about Portland?
The city of Portland, actually, under Steve Novick's leadership, passed a strong resolution, but they are not able to. They are preempted by the state at passing this kind of legislation. And so the action is all at the state. And there is a bill right now in the legislature that people should be pushing their legislators on. It's being carried, championed by Michael Dembro and actually some of our other Portland legislators, but it is being hung up. It's not been passed, and the people who are pushing it have now just gone to a potential for a ballot referendum. They are starting to gather signatures saying, if we cannot count on the legislature to do such basic labor protections as this, we're going to have to go to a... Yes, exactly.
Right, yeah?
And you also made the point, which I didn't address earlier, but is absolutely correct, that our labor law was not written to cover this contingency, because the assumption that schedules would be regular was so prevalent that it's not mentioned in our labor law and it's not addressed in our big data sets. We don't have good data because people assume regular schedules, which is why we had to go to doing our own study by interviewing with people on the street and backing it up with census data on, okay, what are the populations like in these occupations where people are reporting these terrible conditions.
What are the numbers here? What percentage of the workforce now is irregularly scheduled? The contract workers, independent contractors, and irregular workers like in retail and fast food and lots of other things, hospitals everywhere, universities.
Well, it's a high proportion, as you point out. I mean, as I was mentioning, they're saying 20 to 50% of the total workforce is outsourced at some of our biggest operations. The growth in the U.S. labor force of alternative workers, people in the gig economy, independent contractors, vendors, things like that. And when you are up to 15%, they say that one in six people in the country have very little notice of their schedule, sometimes 24 hours. So these different measures are capturing different things. But it's a high proportion. As you point out, the universities, I found myself testifying on a panel for the Workers' Rights Board, actually, about contingent workers being hired by the city, a public employer that should be setting the standards, and realizing I work at the public university where we do the exact same thing.
Yeah, they're called
adjunct faculty. Exactly.
And there are more and more of them, yes. Who are earning not much, probably less than the minimum wage, if you consider all the time they spend in grading papers and all of the rest of it that is all uncompensated.
Oh, absolutely. And then the commute time running from one place to another.
The answer, of course, is to raise wages greatly and make sure that people have benefits like medical care and there's child care and that they have regular work in all of the things that have to be done in this society. Tell us why training is an absurd response. I mean, training and education, of course, are all good in some ways, but it's not a response to poverty and lack of work.
No. I mean, these are, all work has dignity. These are jobs that need to be done. They're a huge and growing part of our economy. They are not jobs taken by people who are in their teens who will soon go on to become engineers as soon as they go to college.
Everybody,
these are real jobs. It's important work, and we need it. We depend on it. I mean, home health care workers are a giant group who are affected by this kind of irregular scheduling. So just as you say, we need two things especially. We need to improve our labor legislation so that we require employers to pay living wages and provide regular schedules with notice that deal with all of the employees' needs to manage their own family and lives. And we need to go back and look at what we've allowed to happen for the laws regulating union organizing, because collective bargaining can take on these sort of issues, but we have made it so difficult. We have raised so many legal obstacles to union organizing in this country that that has become a very difficult road.
I want to disagree about the we.
Well, we. Correct. That we weren't part of that. We didn't get consulted. You are right.
We tried not to have that. But
there's
a new insurgency going on in America, in this country now, and all over the world. There's lots of reasons for hope that things will radically change and have to radically change in the near future. Anyway, that's my faith. How about you, Mary?
No, you're right. I am absolutely, I think Bernie Sanders' campaign showed it here in town. Jeremy Corbyn's effective win with a very strong labor manifesto in Britain showed the interest, especially of younger Britons, in having a very different economy and world.
Mary King, thanks so much for talking to us today.
Thank you, Bill. It's always a pleasure.
And I stumble to the kitchen, pour myself a cup of ambition, and yawn and stretch and try to come to life. Jump in the shower and the blood starts pumping. Out on the streets the traffic starts jumping, with folks like me on the job from 9 to 5. Working 9 to 5, what a way to make a living. Barely getting by, it's all taking and no giving. They just use your mind.
That was Dolly Parton singing 9 to 5, the title song of the film from 1980, back when workers had plenty of complaints about their exploitation, but at least the hours were more reliable. Before that, we heard Bill Resnick talking with Mary King about irregular scheduling. I'm Fran Michel, and this is the Old Mole Variety Hour. We come to you regularly, reliably, at 9 a.m. on KBOO Portland, your listener-sponsored, volunteer-powered community radio station. Next, we turn from the order of law to the magic of art, with Bookmole Larry Bolden reviewing The Snow Child by Iowan Ivey.
Good morning. I almost never read fantasy literature, and I'm even less likely to review it. However, I was so charmed by Iowan Ivey's The Snow Child that besides buying several copies to send to nieces and nephews, I find I want to talk to you readers about the book this morning. I had never heard of the book nor the Russian fairy tale from which it is spun, but I'm finding many of my reader friends have and have been as struck with it as I. Part one of the book is headed by a quote from Arthur Ransom's Little Daughter of the Snow, quoting, "Wife, let us go into the yard behind and make a little snow girl, and perhaps she will come alive and be a little daughter to us." "Husband," says the old woman, "there's no knowing what may be. Let us go into the yard and make a little snow girl." Close quote. Ivy is from Alaska, and this is her debut novel, a story of a couple in their 50s who decide to move to Alaska and to farm there. It is the wife, Mabel, who lobbies strongest for the reclusion, but both seem attracted to a life distanced from others. Her husband and her husband's family own a farm in the eastern United States, so he knows farming. Her parents are educators and are flabbergasted by their daughter's moving into a remote unknown. This is 1920, and the growing season in Alaska is very short. Tough place to homestead. What the reader comes to discover is that Mabel is childless and her husband Jack's family is teeming with children. Quoting from the book, "There had been the one, a tiny thing, born still and silent. 10 years passed, but even now she felt herself returning to the birth." And moving on, quoting again from the book, "Mabel had known that there would be silence. That was the point, after all. No infants cooing or wailing, no neighbor children playfully hollering down the lane, no pad of small feet on wooden stairs worn smooth by generations, or clackety-clack of toys along the kitchen floor. All those sounds of her failure and regret would be left behind, and in their place there would be silence." Close quote. The silence and loneliness, in fact, lead Mabel to being suicidal. She even ventures onto thin ice that covers a deep hole in the river, daring it to break and let her float away like the maple leaf she sees floating below the surface of the ice. The growing distance between her and Jack is highlighted when she tries to tell him that she had ventured onto the too thin ice, and he simply doesn't hear her. Instead, on a winter snow day after a long and dry summer and fall, there is a perfect snow covering, everything covered with a mantle of light and purity. Jack finds the snow is packable and in a moment of levity suggests that they make a snowman. Mabel says, "A girl, let's make it a little girl." "All right," says Jack. And he, who has some artistic talent, uses his pocket knife to craft a nose and lips for their snow girl. They even use cranberry juice to color the lips. Mabel finds a scarf and mittens for the snow girl. In the sunny morning, there is only the base snow left. The scarf and mittens are gone, but there are fox tracks and what appear to be child's barefoot tracks. Jack has already spotted a fox very close to the farm on several occasions and fears for their chickens. Soon, both Mabel and Jack begin to see glimpses of a young girl in the woods, just a flash of red and blue, gone as quickly as it appeared. And the magical story begins. There is a girl running through the woods, and the fox is hers, raised from newborn pup by her. The magic of the story and the beauty of the descriptions of the Alaskan landscape continue throughout this lovely tale, and easily allow the suspension of disbelief the tale requires. At first, when each of the couple acknowledges to the other that they are seeing a girl in the woods, they suppose it must be a girl from a neighboring farm, a girl actually lost in the woods in winter, and that they must save her. But there are few families in the area and no children missing, and soon enough they discover that the snow girl is quite able to fend for herself and her fox in the frozen woods. Explanations are hatched or presented to explain how she can live in such conditions and how she came to be there. Eventually she comes to them, sits with them, eats with them, but only in the winters. When spring comes, she disappears back into the woods and to higher elevations. I fear I'm already telling too much of the story, and Ivy tells it so well that you need to read it in her words, and read it to your children in her words. I can visualize so clearly the girl, Faina, hunting with her red fox at her side. I understand on such a deep level the couple's wanting to keep her to them, and her understanding of why she must remain Faina of the woods. Despite Mabel's rejection of almost any form of attention or sympathy, she is more or less forced into accepting a neighbor woman as a friend. The friendship and conversations between the two women add a feminist substance to the novel. While this is a fairy tale, it is one with many twists, twists of mystery, twists of romance. As one commentator suggests, it never goes where you expect it to go. And it is a lovely tale of Mabel's existential awakening, that we are being with, which is one of Martin Heidegger's existentialia, one of the universal and necessary conditions of what it is to be human. I read this a couple of weeks ago and would not have planned to review it, but it is still so much with me, so charming and informing, so full of delight. If I had children, I would read this to them eagerly, though it is a long story, a story for camping, for imagining and wondering. I have been talking about Iowan Ivey's novel, The Snow Child. This is Larry Bolden for the Old Mole Variety Hour.
That was Oscar Peterson playing That Old Black Magic. And before that, we heard book mole Larry Bolden reviewing the magical story of The Snow Child by Iowan Ivey. You are listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Portland. And you can find this show and its various component parts online in a day or two via the Old Mole Variety Hour pages on the website for KBOO Portland at kboo.fm. You can also find those by visiting, liking, following the Old Mole Variety Hour on Facebook, and following us at Old Mole on Twitter. Now, we'll be turning to even more radical art, with a reading by Joe Clement and his guest, Raisa, from a work that's available at the Multnomah County Library. And that work is called
Rad Women Worldwide.
And who are we going to read about today, Raisa?
Polystyrene.
In 1976, a British band called the Sex Pistols performed the first ever punk rock concert. This legendary show was loud and sweaty, and in the crowd was a young woman celebrating her 19th birthday.
Her name was Marian Elliott Said, and she wanted to be a singer. She's been writing song lyrics since she was 12. As she watched the man on stage sing wildly, she thought, I can do this too.
She placed an ad in a British music magazine.
Young punks who want to stick it together.
Several musicians responded, and soon they'd started a punk band, X-Ray Specs. She chose the stage name Polystyrene because it was plastic and synthetic. After just 6 rehearsals, they played their first gig at the Roxy, a famous punk club in London. They were an overnight hit. Overnight, Marianne became Polly, and X-Ray Specs became a game-changing punk band.
Polly's mom was Scottish-English, and her father had come to England from the African country of Somalia, speaking little English.
When Polly was a child, her mother moved them from the mostly white suburb of Bromley to the more racially diverse town of Brixton. She felt it would be a less judgmental place for Polly to grow up.
Polly was an adventurous, creative kid who loved to play dress-up. She traveled around England by herself at 8:15, and on returning, opened a small clothing shop where she sold funky clothes and developed her distinctive fashion sense.
She wore military hats, mismatched jewelry, and the brightest colors she could find. She chose baggy clothes because she didn't want people to focus on her body shape.
The British punk scene was often angry and dreary, and dominated by white men. Polly was radically different. A mixed race teenage girl with a huge smile that showed off her silver braces. She sneered the opening lines of her first hit song. Quote, "Some people say little girls should be seen and not heard," end quote, and went on to prove the idea very wrong.
She sang about consumerism, sexism, and unfair beauty standards, and she used humor and sarcasm to get her point across. For Polly, punk rock was about young people getting up and doing something, creating something. It was a way for her to express her emotions and ideas.
X-ray specs became very popular very fast. But the fame was overwhelming, and after a few years, Polly grew tired of it all. She left the band, had a daughter, and focused on her spiritual practice. She kept making music throughout her life. Her final album was released the day after she passed away from breast cancer at age 53. In the brief life of X-Ray Specs, they became one of the most popular punk bands ever. Polly has been an inspiration to singers like Kim Gordon, Kathleen Hanna, Beth Ditto, and many more. In honor of Polly starring in X-Ray Specs, here is their first song, "Oh Bondage Up Yours."
Some people think little girls should be seen and not heard, but I think, oh bondage up yours! 1, 2, 3, 4!
That was Polystyrene and X-Ray Specs. And before that, we heard Jo Andresa reading about her from the volume Rad Women Worldwide, written by Kate Schatz and available at the Multnomah County Library. This is the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Portland. And you can always find our podcast at the website, kboo.fm. And you can find those segments in a day or two. The whole show will be available. Our past shows are there. And you can get in touch with us through that site or through our email at gmail, oldmolevarietyhour@gmail.com. My name's Fran Michelle. Our engineer is Patsy Kullberg. Finally today, we're going to be hearing from Desiree Helligers, talking with Maria Hernandez Segoviano of Opal Environmental Justice about public transit in Portland and in Oregon.
Thanks, Fran. So my guest today again is Maria Hernandez Segoviano, and she is the advocacy coordinator for Opal Environmental Justice Oregon. So thanks so much for joining me today, Maria.
No, thank you for having me. It's a pleasure.
Yeah. So we're really celebrating a little bit Opal's really significant victory in, you know, this long-term campaign that you've had to get a low-income fare in Portland or in the metropolitan region. And so you managed to secure $12 million in low-income fare in this new transportation package that was passed about 10 days ago, I think July 7th.
Yeah, we're definitely in a celebratory mode, especially recognizing the hard work that our Bus Riders Unite have done to make this happen. And we're really proud to really make sure that that comes to be and be implemented soon.
Okay, and that low-income fare applies to, it reduces by 50% the fare for anyone making 200% or less of the national poverty line.
Correct.
Okay. But that was not, you weren't entirely pleased with this package. Is that accurate to say?
Yeah. So perhaps I can offer just a little bit of background as well in terms of the transportation package and where that money comes for the low-income fare. For our analysis, you know, the transportation package has been an effort this entire last session in Salem. And we've been at the table, we've been having those conversations and making sure that our Bus Riders Unite and the members who we organize, their priorities were set. And so while, to your point, we are not necessarily happy with the way in which the transportation package is getting funded, especially the low-income fare, we also recognize that it's a huge investment for the state of Oregon when it comes to multimodal transportation, which includes walking, biking, and transit.
And so we're talking about $103 million a year over a 10-year period is what has been allocated to those three kind of multimodal forms of transportation that include bus, walking, and biking?
Yes, and specifically to the transit side of things, it's where that money would come to fund the low-income fare, among other things such as service enhancement program or the programs that either TriMet or other mass transit agencies have around the state of Oregon. And so along that too, there comes this ability of making sure that that money is specifically used for public transit moving forward.
Okay, so TriMet is actually going to have to go back to ODOT with a proposal about how they're going to spend their share of those funds. Is that correct? And so there's some oversight to ensure that they use those funds effectively?
Yes. And when we're talking about oversight more specifically as well, so as you know, right, Opal organizes folks, and we continuously make sure that our members are building power and are building their own leadership, because we recognize that they're all leaders, and it's just a matter of owning and embracing that. So when we were advocating, when we started working with the transportation package and making sure with once Governor Kate Brown introduced this as one of her priorities, we wanted to make sure that this was something where our members were included, especially given that they're the most impacted and they're the riders of Portland's transit system. And so when we were in Portland and advocating and making sure that we were following the conversation, we also made sure that the things that they wanted to have in the transportation package, especially in the transit system or in the transit part of the package, what were going to be implemented, given that there was going to be a wage tax in terms of the funding as a funding mechanism for them. So we wanted to see some oversight and some accountability for sure.
Okay. And so that wage tax is sort of on the more regressive end of this package, and it amounts to 0.1% of the annual income of the worker.
Correct. Right.
So essentially, you know, we've got some benefits in terms of getting that low income fare, but also having low income workers pay into that fund through that.
Yeah, and for us, we sometimes I see it as paying double, right? Paying double into the system. You're already a writer, you're already paying, and then you're being asked to pay a wage tax. So again, it really goes to reiterate that when we were there, we wanted to make sure that what was political feasible was also not placing bigger burdens on workers and folks who already use the system and who unfortunately have to pay double. But we again make sure that through the low income fare, that this is a way for them to also make sure that the transit system and that TriMet in this case is making sure to follow through on not placing more burden on them.
Okay, yeah. And so having that additional oversight of TriMet by ODOT to ensure that those funds are used responsibly, it is kind of critically important given some of, I want to say, Opal's other critiques of, you know, uses of TriMet funds that have not, I think, been responsive to, you know, the rider constituents' needs, including the, what is it called, the HopFast Pass electronic pass system, which has been, you know, the cost of that has been anywhere between, I've seen estimates as low as $22 million and as high as almost $40 million for an electronic pass system that really has, it sounds like, had minimal uses for low-income riders.
Yeah, and actually, the low-income fare came out of that introduction of the Hot Pass when last February in 2016, when riders specifically first started looking and seeing that there was going to be this new introduction of electric Hot Pass or electric just fare charging system. We then started asking the real questions of what would that mean for low-income individuals who, one, don't have access to things such as credit cards, bank accounts, etc. And we wanted to make sure that as TriMet was implementing this new way of charging for fares, that they were taking into consideration that not everybody is able to access that electronic system. And the low-income fare came to be the campaign that came out of that to really make sure that individuals who are most impacted are able to access, are able to say what they need, and are also able to make sure that they see the implementation of that new project or that new way of charging for fares.
Okay, yeah. And I mean, I know Opal has hit really hard the links between gentrification and the need for low-income fares. That people who are low-income people, people of color disproportionately, are being forced out to the periphery of the city and are encountering more and more expenses related to transportation without the public infrastructure that's really meeting their needs.
Right. And we always know through, you know, personal experiences as well, through our members, where you live determines where what type of transportation you take. And also what type of transportation you take determines where you live. We still have really inaccessible transportation over in Gresham during south northbound that doesn't have accessible transit, and there's no weekend lines even still then. So for us, housing and transportation are intertwined and are an environmental justice issue because you can't separate one or the other. They're really at that core of intersection for folks who get to experience that.
Okay, yeah. And it's also worth noting, I think, that back in, I think, April, Mayor Wheeler seemed to be pushing really hard for a fleet of electric cars that would be powered by PGE. He had a breakfast, I think, with the Portland Business Alliance to kind of push that idea. So we're hearing a lot of focus on autonomous vehicles at a moment when a lot of people, you know, that's simply, they're simply priced out of that as a mode of transportation, which makes it that much more key that we have, you know, accessible public transportation. And is it fair to say that we have kind of two, almost a class system with respect to bus riders and light rail riders, that you know, that some communities don't have as much access even to light rail as they do to bus?
I mean, that's definitely true. I think with your question in terms of autonomous vehicles, it's really thinking about, you know, this new economy that it seems that Mayor Wheeler may be talking about, but making sure that doesn't come out of the price of workers and that doesn't come up more burdened on low-income folks, because yes, low-income folks may not have as much access to autonomous vehicles, to all of these other things. Even now, right? Like when we think of what type of vehicles we own or low-income folks own, they're not the fanciest. They're not, you can say, the most priciest. They're just a vehicle that gets you to work and where you need to go to make sure that you're able to provide for your family, that you're able to provide other things. So it's just about making sure that this new economy doesn't come out of with more prices and more burdens on low-income folks. And that's something that we definitely will track moving forward. And we'll see where the conversation needs to go.
And it sounds like you've also been really critical of Lyft and Uber as, you know, sharing economies that actually are taking away from living wage jobs of often largely immigrant, you know, new arrivals in terms of the drivers.
When you say critical, I think it's also just making sure that, you know, again, for us is thinking about labor rights. When I said earlier, housing and transportation being intertwined, you also think about labor rights, mm-hmm. and who is paying for what and for what kind of system, for what kind of transportation we have. And so it's about making sure that the economy, in terms of, in this case, Lyft and Uber, is able to make sure that workers are not being pushed to the bottom of that economy, and making sure that they are able to access whatever good may come out of this economy.
Yeah, so it's really arriving at a time when you've got a union cab company that's really fighting for the rights of and living wages for immigrant drivers.
Yeah.
Yeah. So are there other aspects of the transportation package that we haven't had a chance to talk about yet that you'd like to mention? I know the Amalgamated Transit Union drivers have been pretty critical of this package as well.
Yeah, we are also tracking, you know, with the transportation package, there's also good things, especially for Safe Routes to School. There's going to be funding for Safe Routes to School to make sure that individuals, kids, are able to walk and have safe routes going to school. So there's things about the package, as mentioned earlier, that to a certain extent, we wish it would have been better in terms of funding. But also, again, I think it's a topic that is not over, mm-hmm. Especially given that it's going to come for rulemaking processes next year. And that's something that we as OPAL, we will continue to track, and we will continue to make sure that our folks' priorities are included in that rulemaking conversation.
Yeah, it might be worth talking a little bit more about the impacts of fare evasion and the enforcement around fare evasion, because that's another campaign that you've been working really hard on, is to decriminalize fare evasion. Do you want to talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, during the legislature this year, and I mean, it's been a campaign for a couple of years now in 2015, really thinking about how do we decriminalize our transit system, because oftentimes low-income folks are often criminalized for being poor. And so our goal this session as well, given the opportunity to work with some of the senators, is to making sure that fare evasion is not something you get criminalized for. I mean, before the new bill that passed, Senate Bill 357, which deals with interfering with public transit, you would get an IPT and that would be immediately a Class A.
Class A misdemeanor.
Exactly. Yeah. And that it's similar to a DUI. So for us, it's thinking about how do we move forward? How do we make sure that folks are not being criminalized in that manner? So the bill now establishes that you would get an IPT and it will be Class C misdemeanor. But after the third sort of strike out, it will become a Class A again. Obviously, you know, we will continue to work together with our members or riders to make sure that the decriminalization continues, because folks deserve to use transit and access transit and not be criminalized for not being able to pay $2.50 or whatever amount of money is being asked, whether you're a youth or an older individual.
Yeah, yeah. And I think, you know, people seem largely unaware of how sweeps are conducted in a way that can be very intimidating and it's a very kind of militarized operation. Mm-hmm. So that's something that I know that you've been campaigning against, this practice of sweeps. So we're almost out of time here, and I'm just wondering, I just want to mention really quickly that Willamette Week did do an article a while back, just a couple months ago, about the prospect of Governor Brown privatizing TriMet. So that's something, undoubtedly, you'll be privatizing light rail specifically. So that's something that you'll be keeping an eye on, I have no doubt. So thank you so much. My guest today, again, has been Maria Hernandez Segoviano, and she's the advocacy coordinator for OPAL Environmental Justice Oregon. Thanks so much, Maria.
Thank you for having me. Thank you.
That was, of course, Duke Ellington with Take the A-Train. And before that, Desiree Helliger is talking with Maria Hernandez Segoviano about public transit here in Portland, Oregon. Thanks for listening today to the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Portland. Thanks to Bill Resnick and Mary King for their discussion of work schedules. Thanks to Larry Bolden for his review of The Snow Child. To Joe Clement and Raisa for their selection about rad woman polystyrene. And thanks to Patsy Kahlberg for engineering. I'm Fran Michel. I've been your host today. The Mole will be back next Monday with more views, reviews, and interviews. Thanks, KBOO members, for your generous support. If you're not a current member, you can become one by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate. We'll be back next week with the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Portland.